Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Pulitzer Prize winner Junot Diaz's first book, Drown, established him as a major new writer. His first novel, The Brief, Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, won the Pulitzer Prize, was named number one fiction book of the year by Time magazine, and spent more than 100 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, establishing itself as a modern classic. Now Diaz turns his talent to the haunting, impossible power of love. Obsessive love, illicit love, fading love, maternal love. This Is How You Lose Her features nine stories. At the center of each is Junior, making his third appearance in Diaz's work, a Dominican-American who, despite his macho exterior, aches to be loved. Junot Diaz's fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, The Paris Review, and The Best American Short Stories. He was born in the Dominican Republic, raised in New Jersey, and is a professor at MIT. It's a great pleasure to welcome Junot Diaz to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
No, thank you so much for having us.
It is safe to say that this collection has been in the works for a long time.
Yes, I feel that's the way of all my work. It takes forever.
Have you been able to figure that out, of why it takes so long?
It seems that I require an enormous amount of steeping in these characters for them to say anything to me. It's almost as if some writers just have to make the characters their friends. I seem to have to make them my family, and that takes a long time.
When you originally started out writing short stories, was that the case, that even to do a story, you had to immerse yourself wholly into that family?
It's funny. I think I started out writing very slowly, and then I became much slower once I published my first book. But certainly there's always been a tendency in my own art to have to hover, to have to haunt my characters a long time before I feel any real connection.
What is it about this particular character, Junior, that is someone that stayed with you for so long?
He always has felt very representative of a certain kind of an experience that isn't always sort of visible or most people are not aware of. Junior was an immigrant from the Dominican Republic, young, came over to the States, pretty much becomes a real hardcore Jersey kid. And he's the kind of immigrant kid who, quote unquote, makes good. He ends up going to college. He ends up doing something white collar for himself. Yeah. Becomes a writer, becomes a college professor. But what I think is most fascinating about him is how many different worlds he's lived in. He's lived in so many different worlds by the time he becomes an adult. Second of all, he's this weird, strange mixture of super smart, super sensitive, and bafflingly deceptive.
Much was made when you hit the literary scene of how autobiographical that character is. And obviously, there are connections of the character you just described in your own story. Have you tried to back off from that?
Well, no. I mean, I think in the end, there's always a sense, if any writing feels palpable, if any writing feels sort of, it has that kind of granular sense of the real, there's always this longing among readers to connect it back to the writer. So my sense of this has always been to actually play even closer to the line than before. This book, for example, about Junior's sort of rise and fall as a cheater has a lot of sort of parallels to my own life. But in the end, I'm always left with the feeling and the awareness of how fictional it is. But I don't actually mind if people confuse the character in the book for me, as long as sort of the book invites them to certain kinds of reflection and opens up certain kinds of conversation.
You started writing these stories and about this character how many years ago?
Wow, that's a really great question. That's 18 years ago I started on this little journey.
So you were in your 20s.
And I had tons of hair. You know, I was super young. I could like drink all night and then go for a run at 6 a.m. Man.
So is writing about that character now that you have matured, as we all do, is there a maturity in the character? Is it any different in writing about that character?
Without any question. Without any question. I think that the Junior that we encounter in this book, as opposed to the Junior we encounter in my first book, Drown, is a Junior far more aware of consequences, far more aware of how irrevocable some of our choices are, how we can make decisions and we can make choices, and it closes parts of our lives that we can never get back again. I think that that's something that in some ways is a wisdom that comes with age. I think consequences wasn't something that I nor my protagonist was aware of when we first embarked on this journey. Now, of course, it feels very acute and very present.
And is there anything to be said that just because of that time that you know this character better?
You know, it is. It's the same sort of in real life. Even though you're the same person, you find yourself facing all sorts of new challenges. Like, I kind of barely got a handle on what it meant to be young, and I was already in my 20s. You barely get a handle to that, you're in your 30s. And so I do think you know the character, but if you're like me and always trying to push them into new places, what they have to deal with, this entire new world, requires you, the writer, to rethink, to sort of reflect. And in fact, the knowing them only goes so far.
What is so incredible in this book is the balance of this character, of the vulnerability, how maddening this person can be, and yet ultimately endearing, accessible, and somebody that we like.
I mean, you want to try to go as a writer. You want to try to show as many sides of a character as possible. I don't think it's enough for a character to be quote-unquote likable. I don't know about you. I don't know about anyone else who's listening to this. But if you cracked me open and you were able to have access to all of my thoughts, all of my decisions, everything that I have done in my entire life, I'm not sure on balance that I would immediately come out as an incredibly likable person. I think few of us would be. But if you reflect on a person long enough and you realize that we're all imperfect, I mean, we all have flaws. We all make bad decisions. We've all been cowards at times, but we've also done things that are good. We're also compassionate. We've made important relationships. All of us, to be human means to be in many ways a profoundly mixed bag. And I guess I was trying to get at Junior is that to make him a human being, I needed to be assured or to certainly give him these aspects that were both positive, negative, banal, interesting. And, you know, if anyone likes it, it's probably they're going to like this book because this character strikes them as someone real.
When you look at it as 200 plus pages about this character and the fact that he is a cheater, we have 9 stories about these relationships that often do not put him in a very good light.
No.
So is it a balance to make him then someone that we will relate to and someone that we have compassion toward?
It's tough, man. Have you ever thought about, just from a reader's point of view, how little access we sort of have to the kind of male subjectivities that we spend all our days surrounded by? I mean, growing up, when I was reading, I would read plenty of books where the main characters, the main protagonists were boys. But rarely did those boys correlate even remotely to the kinds of ways me and my male friends were thinking and talking. And I guess that there was a part of me that knew that it was going to be very dicey to sort of deal with this kind of boy, Junior, that he was going to, for many people, be very repellent. His preoccupation with relationships, his preoccupation with love, his inability to keep a relationship, that this was going to kind of wild some people out. But I do think that there's plenty of guys like this, and they are deserving of, I think, our interaction and I think of our imaginations.
You write in the book early on, all of Magna's friends say I cheated because I was Dominican, that all us Dominican men are dogs and can't be trusted. I doubt that I speak for all Dominican men, but I doubt they can either. From my perspective, it wasn't genetics. There were reasons, casualties. You are, in a sense, telling us not just about men, but also about Dominican men.
Well, the reverse, not just about Dominican men, but about boys. I think what's so interesting about this case is that, you know, it's a local argument for a larger problem. Yeah, like I don't think that there's any group in this world that you could grab the women of that group and say, hey, how do you view the men of your group? Do you give them an A? Do you give them a B? I mean, if you got American women to vote on American men as a group, we wouldn't get above an F minus. And so I guess my argument would be that boys tend to misbehave as much as anyone will allow them. And that misbehavior sort of rebounds on them. You can't be a jerk for so long without that jerkness eating up your insides. So I guess I was doing the reverse. I was using Dominican men to talk about the rest of us.
When you look at the language, and I'd like to talk about the language of the book, because how long can you work on dialogue?
You can work on it till you get it right. I mean, you can work on it till you get it right. You know, dialogue is a very, very peculiar mode.
How reflective do you want it to be?
I don't think it can be reflective. I don't know if you've ever read transcripts.
Yes.
Reading transcripts makes you realize how affected dialogue is.
Yes.
Because when you read real transcripts, you realize that nobody talks the way anyone talks in a book. And so part of what I'm doing is I'm trying to give the illusion of speech. I am not in any way creating real speech. This is just the illusion. And sometimes something very, very fake can go a long way for making a sentence or making an interaction seem very, very real. So yeah, I spend a lot of time on this.
And for the characters to sound the way that you want them to sound, do you hear that dialogue or is that created?
No, I mean, you end up hearing it in this process. You end up sort of, you end up having your characters talking to you a little bit. Yeah, but it also has to live on the page, too. So sometimes I'll hear my character say something, and then I'll write it down, and I'll think, this sounded better in my head, you know?
Yeah.
It's got to be somewhere how amphibious.
I love reading this book, or any of your work, actually, on my iBook, because then when you come to a word that I don't know, which comes up often, and then I press define, it says no definitions found. I like that. You've stumped it. That's great.
Yeah, well, they're going to hook these things up to Google pretty quick soon. So I think that'll be gone, man. I think that'll be gone.
But that doesn't bother you, does it?
No, I mean, I'm an inveterate reader. Reading to me is my great vocation. And anyone who reads knows that part of reading, part of the good faith of reading is that we all know that we're not going to get 100% of what's on the page. There's no way that you can read a novel and really understand more than 80% of what's happening, whether it's the level of language, it's at the level of signification. And so part of reading is having a great tolerance for encountering words where when your brain runs over them, it says no definition found. And I think that that's the normal part of reading. I think because I use words that are like in nerdish, words about comic books, or words that are in Spanish, or words that are in kind of an African-American urban slang, you know, I think that that hides the fact that this is a very common experience in all reading.
And with that common experience and our understanding, it comes off, though, that we are in a conversation that we like. In the sense that it's enjoyable.
We hope. I mean, enjoyable or at least somewhat provocative. And
I mean
by provocative, not just to be provocative for provocative sakes, but that it gets you talking, having a conversation. I think every part of a book is an attempt to get you to start either a conversation with yourself or a conversation with someone else.
When you look at the character of Junior, and we talked about the whether there is an autobiographical quality to this character or not, but when you look at this character's growth and development, how does it run parallel with your growth and development as a writer, of being able to express that character?
That's tough, man. I think it's hard to say. I mean, I think I've lived with these characters and I've lived with this world a very long time. And there's a part of me that knows that I've learned things as a writer I can't necessarily use in these stories and in this book. But there's also things that I've learned from these characters that have been very useful to me as a writer. For example, you know, the revelation, which perhaps for many people this is already something that's obvious, but for me, the revelation of how falling in love is in many ways about allowing yourself to be found out, allowing yourself for someone to know you. And that in many ways, reading a book is a process of finding something out. A book is usually coded as a mystery. You know, what we know at the end is far more than we know at the beginning, whether it's a level of character, plot, or, in you know, anything like that. So I guess, you know, that there's this revelation that I got with my, you know, thinking about these characters and thinking about love and realizing that, you know, love, falling in love is a lot like, you know, the process of reading or being inside of a book. Both of them depend immensely on the process of discovery.
Also, in that discovery, we learn in this book, and it is magnified, of just how important our friendships are.
Yeah, especially if you have really crazy friends, you suddenly realize those crazy friends could suck us into crazy stuff.
And that's a fascinating aspect of who we love and how we react to that person and what we do, of how it is reflected often in who we associate ourselves with.
No question. I mean, I have to say, Junior spends a lot of time in this book with some very questionable cats. In many ways, they're an echo of his oldest brother, his old brother's pattern. You know, it's a pattern with him of spending a lot of times with questionable cats that started very young.
The character Rafa.
Yeah, Rafa.
This is a character who deals with cancer, something that your brother dealt with. So again, we go back to the autobiographical, does that in and of itself have a reflection on the relationship, or is it any mountain that we climb reflective of a sibling relationship?
Well, I mean, I think having a close brother helps you to frame and to create another brotherhood. I think having a brother who survived cancer and you having kind of a front row seat to that experience gives you insights and information that you might not have otherwise had and gives you a range of emotional history that you can draw upon. But, you know, Rafa in this book, he is so unlike my brother and his experience. I mean, he is the most nightmarish cancer patient you have ever seen. He's the kind of guy that you can't even imagine. Where my brother, of course, I think was far more typical, very, very scared, you know, very worried, very brave. Where Rafa is just, he's almost satanic in his unwillingness to recognize that anything is happening. And the way that he spirals upwards towards more and more cruelty, the sicker he gets, he's kind of a wild dude that way.
How did your brother react to that?
Right? Not that way. My brother became far more compassionate and far more understanding about...
No, but reading about.
Oh, my brother hasn't read this stuff. I mean, it's funny. I don't know if my family reads me. I think my family's far too worried. They're just like, you know what? We'll wait till we're way older.
I was lucky enough, right after you won the Pulitzer, you did an event at Princeton University, and I was lucky enough to attend that event. And there was such a joy and a buoyancy in that room for you, and a buoyancy and joy, I think, that exuded from you. And you talked about even the relationship and how it impacted the conversations you were having with your mother. Does it fundamentally change you, or does that wear off and go away fairly quickly?
Oh, very, very quickly. Yeah. Really, it always comes back to the work. Winning is nice. Winning anything is really nice. But then you wake up the next day and you're who you are. And you've got to keep you going with your work. Whatever you've dedicated your life to, that you have to return to always after the celebration. And all my relationships with my family, all my relationships with my friends quickly reasserted themselves. And there was just the fact that you got to get up every day. You got to fight to be a good person in a world that encourages us not to be good people. And you got to do the best work that you can possibly do, because work is an ennobling, you know, it's an ennobling practice.
In teaching students at MIT, what advantage do you think you have? What can you teach them through your experience?
I don't know if I teach them to my experience per se, but you know how it is. When you work with kids, you suddenly realize, man, I know a lot more than these kids. You know, and especially when it comes to writing and creating art. I mean, it's nothing personal, but I'm like, damn, oh, I know a lot of crap. I know a lot of stuff. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to, of course, teach them all the things you know, but you're also trying to model things. You're trying to model your enthusiasm. You're trying to model your compassion. And you're trying to model ethical behavior. I mean, that's all the parts of what it means to be a pedagogue, to be a teacher. And I think that I'm more than anything, if I can communicate to my students that I am enthusiastic about art, I feel like I've done more than half my job.
I found it interesting in reading a recent interview with you that you have said that you would be happy if you never wrote another short story.
Yeah, short stories are difficult, man. I don't know about anyone else. I don't have a huge executive function when it comes to my work. My work calls me and then I'm stuck with it. So a short story will call me and I'm like, damn, I got to work on another short story. And then it takes me a couple years to write. It takes a long time for me to write stories. And then what you do is you get so little of them. They're so tiny. They're so little. I would rather be called to do something big, and when you're done, you'll have a book. It seems a lot easier in some ways. I get super tired by the end of a short story.
Was Oscar Wow easier in that sense?
Well, at least it was a full book. You know, I was like, wow, I got done. By the time I got done, I had a book. Usually by the time I get done with a story, I've got a ninth of a book. So I don't know. I mean, I'm just sure this is the doldrums. This is kind of the post-work, you know, hangover. I'm sure I'll wake up in a couple months from now and find myself working on another short story. But for the moment, I feel really drawn to big, big canvases.
When you look at this book as a whole and the fact that it is connected, do you still consider it a collection of stories?
I don't.
I
mean, that's why it doesn't say stories on
right.
it. It's not simply just an economic consideration. It's because I think this book, like Drown, my first book, are both hybrids. They're neither a classic story anthology, nor are they novels. They are something in between. Most people would just call this thing a novel and get it over with, you know, make it easier. But I guess part of me enjoys the game where it's the reader who assigns what this book is. I really like that. That's why I leave that damn thing open.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, it makes the publishers just furious because they would rather have novels. But, you know, I'm just like, hey, man, this book is a lot more novel than a lot of novels that are made up of stories that call themselves novels. And I just want my readers to be the one who decides in the end what these books are.
But this particular book, did it come in parts?
No, this particular book was made in pieces, but it began with a single vision, a project vision, that I said, I want to write a follow-up book to Drown. In my mind, it was going to be fast. I was going to write it in a year. 16 years later, I realized I was real wrong. And I wanted to write a sort of a follow-up book to Drown, which was specifically a story of the rise and fall of Junior as a cheater. And I thought I would tease out from Drown all the kind of infidelity stuff and all Junior's difficulties with intimacy and make a book out of it. We would see how he begins and how he ends. And so that's how the project began, with this larger sort of over-narrative. But the finding the stories that would fulfill that narrative, that was hard.
When you consider now that the book is done, so the hope would be a novel.
You mean up next?
Yes.
Oh, I hope so. I'm done. I want to go work on my sort of virus, monster, Dominican Republic, Haiti invasion story. That's what I want to work on for a while.
End of the world?
Yes. Yeah.
Think about that.
That'll
keep you wondering for a while, won't it?
Well, I hope so. I mean, you know, the dream always with me is to get things done fast. The reality is that it'll probably take me 20 years.
The new novel is This Is How You Lose Her. It's published by Riverhead. Juno Diaz, I thank you so much for being with us. A real, real treat to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. The show is recorded at the Radio Foundation in New York City. My thanks to their team. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.